Coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK,
The Lutheran Inquisitor, examining pressing issues and their ramifications for the Church today. Christian martyrdom is the topic of today's show with your host, Pastor John Ehlers.
Welcome to The Lutheran Inquisitor. Today, we are pleased to have Dr. William Weinrich as our guest. Dr. Weinrich is professor of early church history and patristics at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. Weinrich did his doctoral studies at the University of Basel in Switzerland, and he's taught at Concordia Theological Seminary since 1965. Dr. Weinrich has served for 30 years in the U.S. Air Force Reserves. He has spent many years in Latvia working with the Lutheran Church of Latvia, and he has served as both the fifth and third vice president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Dr. Weinrich recently gave the keynote address at the International Lutheran Council's World Seminaries Conference in Palanga, Lithuania, on Christian martyrdom. Dr. Weinrich, welcome to Lutheran Radio UK. In your paper, you talked about Christian martyrdom. It's a word we occasionally hear today, especially in an Islamic context. But can you tell us exactly what the term martyr or martyrdom means?
Yes, in the Christian context, it fundamentally means that one dies as a confession of Christ as Savior and Lord. And it's important to note that in Christian texts, the word martyr, which strictly means witness, does not refer primarily to a verbal witness or confession, but refers to the death itself. And this is a very important point to keep in mind as one considers how early Christians and we today should consider a Christian martyrdom as a publicly imposed death because of Christian faith. So the witness that one gave as a martyr was the death itself. And within that confession lay the fundamental assertion that one is a Christian by way of one's identity. Not simply what one believed to be true, but who one was, namely a child of God. So there's a lot within that little definition, but maybe that's a helpful place to begin.
Yeah, and let's try to begin to unpack that if we can. Would you consider Jesus, I mean, you talked about the martyr is a Christian, a follower of Christ, would you consider him to be the first martyr, if you will?
Absolutely, and I think that's very important to make that very point. Jesus' death is not depicted by the New Testament writers, nor was it understood by early Christian testimony as a piece of bad luck, or as Jesus simply being ill-fated. He was placed on the cross because of his submission to the Father's will. That is to say, he was, as the true Son of God, he was the one who would not abandon, not even for a moment, God's will, and God is his Father. So here the scene of Gethsemane is really quite crucial, where Jesus says, not my will, but yours be done. So Jesus goes steadfastly to the cross because he will not abandon his status as God's Son. So again, it is who Jesus is as the Son of God that brings on his death, not simply that he has run afoul of certain powers in the world.
And in your earlier definition of martyrs, you talked about how they wouldn't give up their ability or their willingness to submit to God's will as his children. Is that a connection then? Because as they are connected with Christ, they will not deny that connection or that confession.
That's correct. And here again, the language of sonship is crucial. In the New Testament, Jesus reveals and manifests his sonship by a willing obedience to the Father's command and will. So in that, he remains steadfast to that will. He shows himself to be son. Now, at this point, it's perhaps also important to note the baptismal character of that kind of language. The language of fatherhood, the language of sonship, finds its proper matrix, context, within Christian baptism. Paul speaks, for example, of baptism as a reception of the Spirit of God, which brings us into sonship. We receive, he says, the adoption of sonship, and because of that, the Spirit leads us to confess God as our Father. So in baptism, we are united with Christ in his sonship, and for that reason can be called, as we often are in the New Testament, children of God or sons of God. So in baptism, we are bound to Jesus, as Paul says, in his death as well as in his resurrection. And it is crucial, especially in the topic we are discussing, it is crucial to keep in mind that this language of Paul, that we are united with Christ in his death, is not merely metaphorical or figurative. It can and often might well take quite literal and fleshly forms, as it did indeed for Paul himself.
You talk about baptism. You also in your paper talked about the Lord's Supper and how it may help us to understand and prepare for martyrdom. Can you talk about how the other sacrament here fits in?
Well, indeed, and in many ways they simply reinforce one another in this point. Maybe we can think of the Lord's Supper as the repeated renewal of our baptismal status. If we think very concretely of our own family life, I, for example, have three children. They are born to me as children, but that tie of family is manifested and made real by the fact that daily we came together at the table. And that meal together was in fact perhaps the most significant way in which that original birth and the relationship that birth established it continues. And so our uniting with Christ in his death by way of our spiritual birth continues to be reinforced by the fact that we partake of the body and blood of Christ given into death. And so in my paper I speak of that then as constantly being bound to Christ in his own destiny, in his own true obedience to sonship. And so in early Christian martyr text, it's not surprising then that baptism could often be used, as was the Eucharist, as kind of sacramental images of that martyr death that may be, if God so wills it, may be, in fact, lived out quite fleshly and with, as they would put it, baptism of blood.
You talk about this martyr death that may have to be lived out. For many in the West today, we often think of it as something in the past. You know, the early church had to suffer. But in your paper, you gave some amazing statistics about how martyrdom affects the church today. Can you talk about, is it a real issue in the church today?
Well, it certainly is, I think. And the paper you referred to was given at a conference in Lithuania where Christian leaders and religious teachers from all over the world were gathered, and I made the comment and observation at that meeting that the fact that martyrdom was the topic of that meeting reflects a new situation for not only Lutheran churches, but for all Christian churches in the world. Now, it is true that we often think of Christian martyrdom as something that happened in the early church or so forth, but a quick survey of Christian history will show that Christian martyrs have existed throughout the history of the church. And as is often observed, nowhere more so than in the last 150 years or so, the 19th century and especially the 20th century, the century just passed, have been, from this perspective, the most bloody part of Christian history. And today, at least two factors, there may be more, but at least two factors are often highlighted to indicate the news context of many Christians in the world. The first factor is that we have a rise of an Islam that is often called jihadist, that is not making room, as often Islam did in the past, but today is not making room for Christian churches in their regions. The Coptic experience today in Egypt is often mentioned, and indeed, in many ways, recent political and military history in the Middle East, especially in Iraq, now also in Syria, is having terrible deleterious effect upon the traditional Christian communities there. It's disastrous from a Christian point of view. But perhaps most interesting, if you will, is kind of the new place that Christians find themselves in the Western world, in your country of Britain, but also in my country of the USA and Western Europe and Canada also in general, where strangely, I might say from the perspective of our own national histories, strangely Christians are being kind of peripheralized quite openly, oftentimes with great hostility, being peripheralized from public life, even being accused broadly of being intolerant or insensitive to people, and this because of quite traditional Christian values and Christian behaviors. And so in a Vatican report that I refer to in my paper, they speak of this sidelining of the Christian conscience from public life, often where our societies even ignore the remarkable and great contributions that Christians have made in social welfare. And in some instances, I know this is true in my country, for example, where by way of court decree and political imperatives, Christian social services are actually closing because of Christian conscience not being able to do certain things. So we have a new circumstance in our world, and I would say also in our own countries, which probably will not lead to actual martyrdom such as we have been speaking, although I suppose in some scenarios that might be conceivable. But it is, in fact, bringing Christians to a point where they must stand steadfastly before public opinion, oftentimes receiving it in that context mockery and dismissal, and perhaps quite rude and hurtful comment.
And with this being the setting of our society today, I really did appreciate in your paper how you used ancient accounts of martyrs to help us to, I suppose, prepare for what may come our way. Can you give us a few examples of some of these accounts of the martyrs and what they can teach us even today?
I make the point that Christian martyrdom, again, defined personal identity. And here again we can go back to what we said about baptism as a new birth, that establishes for the baptized person a set of relationships and obligations that are not natural ones. They are not the relationships that are simply given by way of our so-called earthly existence. But there's a new set of obligations which arise from a new set of relationships. Here again, the baptismal theme is central. We are baptized into Christ, and thereby and therein, God becomes our Father, the Church, if you will, becomes our mother, fellow Christians become our brothers and our sisters. And so it is commonplace in early Christian martyr texts that earthly attachments, and especially the political attachments, but also familial attachments, are seen to be peripheral and secondary, and hence may well have to be given up for confession of Christ. And one of the most interesting and in some ways I think most kind of poignant example of giving up familial ties comes in the Passion of Perpetua and Felicitas. This was an extremely important Latin martyr text written in the context of an early 3rd century persecution, usually dated around 202 in North Africa. Perpetua was a young Roman noble woman. She clearly had a young infant child, and we are told that when she was brought before the governor, her father appears on the scene and pleads with her to give up her Christian faith, to sacrifice to the gods, and not to bring disrepute and mockery upon her family, himself, her mother, her aunt, also her child. And so we see here that to be a good citizen, to be a good social member of the Roman society, included confession to the Roman gods, and included obedience to the Roman will. To her father, Perpetua responds that she cannot do that, that she has a new father, who is God in heaven. And then we are told that on a later day, when she appears in the forum to receive her sentence, the governor appeals to her quite directly, do not dishonor your father and dishonor also your infant. Save them by obeying my command to sacrifice to the gods. To which Perpetua simply responds, Christiana sum, I am a Christian. And here again then we have this repeated Christian confession in those contexts. I am a Christian. And as I want to emphasize, in these early Christian texts, this confession, I am a Christian, did not simply mean that I believe Christian doctrine to be true. I believe that what the Church teaches is true. It was a statement of fundamental identity. And so now when Perpetua actually then suffers martyrdom, her confession or her death contained within itself and was itself the confession that her earthly father was a penultimate relationship that could not finally assume ultimate allegiance for her. Her real father, the one whose fatherhood defined her person, was the God in heaven. And the same is true, and this is what especially makes this little narrative so poignant, is that she also gives up her child. Her infant, likewise, cannot claim for her the ultimate loyalty of a mother. Perpetua's identity is Christian. not mother to an earthly child or daughter to an earthly father. And these are, and when you read an account like this, one begins to glimpse, I think, the kind of ultimate transcendent loyalties that Christian martyrdom acquires and requires. But I would like to emphasize for your audience that that ultimate loyalty lies within Christian baptism. Christian baptism reorients our personal identity towards God as that which has ultimate claim upon us.
And would the same be true with the accounts of the martyrs before the political leaders? Caesar is Lord. Well, no, he's not. God wants us to pray for Caesar. God wants us to obey Caesar as much as we can, but our allegiance is to God.
That's correct. And perhaps kind of out of a certain necessity, this confrontation with political claims is a constant in early Christian martyr texts. I make the point that the Christian witness is fundamentally not a private witness. It is fundamentally a public witness. And this is very important, I think, also in our modern context, where Christian faith increasingly is understood and demanded to be only a private opinion which has no claim to speak in the public square. And it is that kind of privatization of Christian witness that early Christian understanding of martyr cannot abide or allow. The Christian claim, to be sure, contains within itself love for the neighbor. But what grounds that love for the neighbor, what grounds the Christian desire to be a good citizen and a faithful citizen, is in fact, interestingly enough, the unwillingness to allow the social political realities to be ultimate. And so there is precisely within the Christian command to love the neighbor a certain ascetic, if I might put it that way, a certain ascetic element which penultimatizes all earthly powers and things. So to give of one's possession for the neighbor is not simply then some sort of ethical imperative of being good. It contains in itself the fact and the belief that things of the world are fundamentally penultimate. And so one's the Christian caritas towards the world is no different than in at root than the Christian claim that no earthly power can make ultimate claims upon us. And so in early Christian martyr texts, the Christian is always confronted by two claims. The one, on the one side, is the claim of the Roman magistrate, let us say. Serve Caesar by sacrificing to his image. That is to say, to acknowledge the Roman power as an ultimate source of your life. And the Christian martyr must make a choice between that power and the confession that God alone is the creator of all things, the creator of the living. And as I make, or try to make evident in my paper, is that in this conflict, there, in this choice, there is the conflict between the true God and all other powers, where these powers make the claim that if you do my will, you are allowed to live. If you do not do my will, you will not be allowed to live. And it is precisely that claim which provides the temptation to be unfaithful. For the fundamental Christian claim is that God is the source of all life, and that to live truly is to be faithful to Him, and to die truly is to be unfaithful to Him. And so you always have in these early martyr texts this interesting kind of inversion of reality, if you will. If I might mention Perpetua's narrative again about her martyrdom, there is this interesting scene in the Passion of Perpetua where Perpetua has a dream, and she dreams that she is going to fight an Egyptian in the arena, in a wrestling match. And of course, the image of the Egyptian is really the image of Satan, of the devil. And so in this dream, Perpetua comes into combat, a wrestling match with this Egyptian. And there comes a time when we are told that Perpetua grabs hold of the neck of this Egyptian and wrestles him to the ground and is able to step upon his head, okay, and crushes it. There are two things being said here. In the image of the dream, Perpetua is victor. It is the Egyptian who lies dead or defeated in the sand. But in reality, of course, this is an image of her martyrdom. She is the one who actually has died. So the image of the martyr is one who dies, but in dying is precisely the one who lives. Because life is contained within the faithfulness to the true God, who alone gives life, and not faithfulness to the false gods or to penultimate powers, even political powers, who do not have life in themselves, and therefore in any ultimate sense can neither give it or take it away. And so we have in this dream of Perpetua that she receives the laurel wreath of the victor and is walking towards the gate, the Porta Vivarium, the port of the living, which was the place where the gladiators who survived the combat, they would walk through the port of the living. And so we see in Perpetua this living martyr, if you will, who is actually walking through the port, the gate of the living, which in the dream, of course, is an image of her entry into the paradise with God. So you always have in these texts these conflicts of conscience, these conflicts of choice and decision, rooted in the statement or the question, who finally is the giver of life? Who finally is the one who gives and can take life? And of course, as we have also noted, the question, who am I? Am I fundamentally, in my deepest personhood, a Christian? Or am I, in my deepest personhood, one who is attached to things of this life? And martyrdom then places all these things on this, in this kind of pinpoint where there's no neutral ground. You either say yes or no. You are either allow yourself to be given over to the life of this world with all of its attachments, or fundamentally make the claim that the life which God has given you to live and perhaps to die for is what you must choose. But there's no middle ground there. And so I make the claim in my paper, and in many ways it's the fundamental claim of my paper, that in Christian martyrdom, the true relationship between God and the world is revealed. God alone is the one who gives life. God alone is the one who can take it. and therefore God alone is the one who has claim upon our ultimate obedience, and not any other power, be that political, be that earthly attachment to family, race, ethnicity, nation. It doesn't matter. When the Christian confesses, I believe in one God, that contains within itself the demands of Christian martyrdom.
I'm sorry, Dr. Weinrich, but it appears we've run out of time this week. We would invite everybody to tune in next week as we continue our discussion on Christian martyrdom with Dr. William Weinrich of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Thank you for listening to The Lutheran Inquisitor with Pastor John Ehlers. If you have any questions or comments about the issues raised in this program, send an email to info@lutheranradio.co.uk. The podcast of this show is available from our website. Check our program online and stay tuned.